What's your favorite tool? Is it James or Malcolm?
I like you both.
Hang on a minute. Did you just call yourself a tool? Wow.
No, well,
that's brilliant.
I called you a tool.
He calls me a tool. Never mind. Hello, and welcome or welcome back.
Thanks for joining us for another episode.
I'm James Skiffins.
And I am Malcolm Childs, and we, together, are just making conversation.
This week, for a little bit of something different, we're going to discuss with our special guest one of the most amazing figure boutique companies based in the UK.
From flashy sprues to floor polish and everything in between, we are going to just make conversation.
Remember, there are way better podcasts you can listen to.
Head to modelpodcasts.com for the links.
If you've enjoyed our podcast even a tiny bit, consider leaving 5 stars as it promotes this podcast to more people to enjoy.
Showing your support to us is as easy as making a coffee. In fact, why not go over to buymeacoffee.com JMC Podcast and do just that. Your support
will help
go towards making the
podcast and its
content
just
that
little
bit better. little things.
Oh my god.
In this episode, we'll be just making conversation with Robert Lane, a sculptor in miniature who is the founder of Alan 13, a boutique for figure painters.
Getting down and dirty with Robert to discuss just how and why he brings to market the wonderful selection of busts and figures to us.
Why is Alan 13 a boutique company? What drives the business? Just how much difference does it make to know the person behind the door? Does this help us in our journey of bringing a figure to life? While we keep Robert strapped down in the green room
with his M&Ms and sparkly water and all that sort of stuff.
M&Ms, did you pick out all the green ones?
I thought you said he liked all the green ones.
Oh, bugger.
Oh, well.
That's quite an important thing.
Well, to be honest, he did make a different request as well, which I hid from you. He has a secret stash of biscuits. I can't say any more than that. But he may offend you at some point, but please don't take it personally.
How could you possibly be offended by biscuits? What a shallow, low person that would be.
Anyway, the listeners' comments. We've had some emails, would you believe?
We have.
Well, our first email is from Mike Stucker in Sugarland, Texas. And he says, just listen to the latest podcast on gender diversity in the hobby. Really enjoyed it. Great discussion with your guests. One thing you mentioned was trying to find female figures that were, let's say, less bumpy and more respectful to women. I recently finished an Israeli Merkava with all female crew because they do exist in real life. And I did not want pin-up figures. The sitting figure is from Meng. The women standing around on the turret is from Black Dog. And the other two are from Royal Model. You also mentioned looking at figures to go with the Queen Elizabeth figure. I assume you're referring to the Princess Elizabeth figure from SKP Models. A Swiss design out of Japan. Thanks for doing the podcast. JMC is one of my favourites. Thanks, Mike.
Mm. Cheers, Mike. Did you look at the picture from Swiss Design then?
Yes, I did. I did check that out.
Yeah, because that might be what you're looking for.
Can't find any that I can get my hands on, but we'll keep looking.
Got another email here. Would you like me to read this one?
Oh, go on in.
It's from Martin Drayton.
Oh.
Yeah, he said, hi, guys. Thanks for another great podcast. As a Brit living in the States, it's always good to hear British voices every now and again, and you certainly fill that void. Your episode on inclusion and the struggles faced by female modelers was much needed and timely. We really need to get our house in order and drag some of the misogynist dinosaurs into the modern era, he says. I do have an inkling of what your contributors experience as a black man living in the United States. In fact, I have quite a few unpleasant, racially motivated comments on some of my posts since I started back modeling 2 years ago. It almost got to the point where I thought I would remove my profile picture and just put a picture up of one of my builds. Then I thought, screw 'em. I am who I am, and I'm proud of my heritage and my race. Hopefully the spirit of inclusion will at some point reach the darker corners of your hobby. People should not be judged by their gender, ethnicity, sexual preference. We all love the same hobby. Can we not all love each other? Thanks again for doing such a great job. Kind regards, Martin Drayton. I agree.
Yeah.
Can't we all just get along?
It's all about the plastic. It's not about your background or anything else.
Oh, could have a flying f- what if you've got breasts or if you're black or whatever. Doesn't matter.
Absolutely. We also had some coffees bought for us. So thank you very much to Mike Shelley. And he left a comment. He says, he has a wife, you know.
That was it.
That was his comment, yeah. So that was a reference to something I said about my wife, I think.
No. You know what it's from, right?
No.
It's from The Life of Brian.
That's it.
Yeah. Bigus Dickus was the Roman. One. And then Incontinentia Buttocks. He wasn't allowed to put buttocks, I don't think, or something. So we can say buttocks
yes.
on this podcast.
We can. And Bigus Dickus.
Thank you, Mike. That you brought us three coffees. It's very cool. One for each of us. So
yeah, very cool.
One day we'll sit down and have a coffee with you. That'd be great.
That'd be wonderful.
Do you know what I was thinking? When we go to Telford, which is coming up very soon.
Oh, it is.
Literally, we'll be drinking coffee and having literal coffees brought for us.
Mm.
So I wonder if we could cash those coffees in. It's like if I see someone, they go, oh, hello. And I go, oh, yeah. Becca Wahi, you bought us coffee. Can I have that coffee now?
It's a good thought.
We need to get some more stickers made. Give them out, don't we?
Yes, yes. We will have some stickers to give out, and we will be giving out a lot more than we did last year.
Yeah.
But just to remind you, if you haven't already, you've still got just about enough time to get your nuts out.
Mm-hmm.
We will be going round, and we will be awarding a very exclusive prize for you. We have employed a skilled artist to design and put together an incredible prize for the winner of the best nut.
We couldn't afford him, so we got James to do it instead.
Oh, well, yeah. Obviously, if you remember casting your mind back to a couple of episodes ago, we were invited by Callum from Micro Machines Podcast to join in the group build.
I do. I remember. Yes. Is this a group build update?
This is a group build update. Very quickly.
Ooh, just get comfy and tell me all about it.
Okay. So first of all, I got way excited. So excited, in fact, in the episode that I just mentioned a moment ago, just suddenly appeared with this kit from nowhere and said, look, I'm going to build this.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, being the master of reading of English language, I actually bought the prize. Not the kit that we're going to be.
Oh, congratulations. Well done.
So I've won already. What a prize plonker. But anyway, I have cleared up my mistake and I have pulled out of the stash another wonderful kit. So it is... Ta-da! It is the Tamiya United States M8 Light Armoured Car, the Greyhound. Woohoo! In 1/35.
Can you hold up and I'll do a screenshot? Hold up to the camera. Yeah, I'm over here. Don't look at yourself. Look at the camera and smile. God, it's like pulling teeth. Hold it up. Look at the camera and smile. Yeah, I'll do.
I'm super excited about this because it is a subject matter in which I quite like, as it happens. It's been in the stash for a little while. I'd forgotten all about it, but I know exactly what I'm going to do with it. Itching to get started. It's all here. Ooh. It's all in its plastic wrappers. As you can hear, it's not been unboxed. I am going to take some pictures of its said state and post them up on the Facebook group page, Facebook page of Micro Machines Podcast. Yeah, so I'm just going to join in for fun. So I've got some super plans, part of a diorama. So the theme to this, because that probably is quite important to a group build, the theme is Battle of the Bulge. Yes, there's going to be a winter scene. It will be a diorama. And I have been doing a bit of googling and found some images. I've found some YouTube But yeah, I'm going to give it a go. Any of you that are listening want to get involved in a group build to do with the Battle of the Bulge? Great subject. Head over to the Facebook group Micro Machines Podcast and join in. There is a link and there is a YouTube video in which you can get a bit more information on. We'll link that all in the description. Give them support. They're a young, budding podcast crew.
Righto. Yeah, that's cool. Little six-wheeled armored car thing, isn't it? You'll do a fantastic job, buddy. What's the deadline for it?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I can't remember off the top of my head.
Okay. Telford's coming up.
Yes. Oh, I've been waiting all year for this, and I can't wait.
Yeah, me too. And yeah, I've got tons of stuff to do. I've got lots of people to meet. I'll be there with Models for Heroes, and I've got a lot of stuff to get on with. I'm going to be there from Friday morning, setting up. Got a couple of people coming to help out, and I've got lots of dates planned.
Yes.
We're going out on a date, aren't we, James?
We are, yes. We're having all sorts of dates.
Yes. We're going to do some recording, and we're going to try and take lots of pictures, and we're going to try and do a live, aren't we, or something similar?
Not 100% sure how it will work, because the internet at the conference centre is not brilliant, without doubt. But we're going to try and do a couple of lives. Poor old Malcolm. He's got many hats on the weekend, so
yeah,
he has to take precedent on one particular hat. So it might just be me, I'm afraid. But I probably will get him at some point to do something with me. We're going to try and give you some updates and bits and pieces. I'm also going to do a mooch around, I suppose we could call it, of the competition and try and bring together a quick look at the models. And then there might be a little bit more in-depth view of the models. So a couple of bits and pieces to come. We hopefully will have a chat with a few people while we're there.
Yes.
Yeah, we're just going to have a good time. Enjoy the camaraderie and everything that Telford and the show has to offer.
Our fundamental reason for doing Just Making Conversation was just a bit of a giggle, a bit of fun, and it can't get in the way of our enjoyment of the hobby. So we will be enjoying our hobby while we're doing Just Making Conversation bits. But you're right, I've got lots of hats to wear. One of them is a hat, my own hat, so I can actually enjoy the weekend myself. I can't wait. There's going to be loads of people that I haven't seen in a while. Lots of cuddles to be given out.
And lots of cuddles to strangers as well that we've spoken to in many formats before but never physically seen them.
See you there if you're going. If you're not going, then hopefully we'll be able to bring you some content that you can make you feel like maybe you were there.
The Moose Roo Cup. Let's talk about the Moose Roo Cup. Boom!
Woohoo! Don't need to do a Moose Roo Cup update because I have not done any Moose Roo Cup. For those who don't know, a competition between all the podcasts. We'll build the same kit that's been supplied by IPMS Hamilton in Canada. That's going to be completed around March, and I haven't started mine yet. I know a lot of other guys have. I've been watching with great interest a little group we've got going on Facebook, and we are, well, I'm not, but I'm watching other people post pictures of their triumphs and difficulties. It has been great, because when I do start doing the kit, someone's ploughed that channel for me, so I know exactly where I'm looking. I know exactly where the pitfalls could be. Mm-hmm. A couple of people have had the same problem. A couple of people have had different problems. So, but in the main, people are quite impressed with the kit, I think.
Yeah, it's come across that way.
That's the 172nd Mustang P51B from Armour Hobby. So I'll be building that. That's all the Moose Roo update. That is it. Modeling wise, I haven't really done anything this week. I've just been too busy. I've put my Corsair on a frame. That's about it.
Mm.
But it looks good. So I'm excited about doing that one day when I get around to it. I'm going to try and do it over Christmas break. That's the plan.
Yeah.
Well, it was going to be try and do it at the end of October, but it's nearly at the end of October. Mm-hmm. So, I'm supposed to be doing a buddy build with a friend called Steph. And he's waiting to do it. So I feel a bit guilty about that, but it is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's got to get done. It'll get done when it gets done.
Yeah, absolutely.
This weekend, I'm doing a little 48-hour group build with our Netherlands friends. Scale Models for Vets.
Yes.
Yep. I've bought myself a kit. The theme is The Future Is Now. So I'm going to try and grab some time on a Saturday or Friday evening maybe, and sit and build the kit with the guys who are going to be live on Facebook and YouTube, I think.
Yes, they are.
So that's going to be cool. I'm looking forward to that. The kit. Do you want my crosses?
No.
No. Do you want me to show you?
Yeah, show me, because I mean, I'm intrigued.
Here we go. So I got it at the last model show that I went to, which was the Rimi model show in RAF Lyman in Swindon. And there it is.
Oh. See that?
Yeah, so Macross is kind of a cross between, it's all about music and robots and they kind of transform into aeroplanes. It's very hard to explain. You have to watch it. Go on YouTube. The one I've got is the VF-1 Battle Droid, which is the one of the earlier ones from Do You Remember Love? Which is one of the films. I tried to watch it on YouTube the other day. Crikey. I don't know what's going on. But what's really important is that the ships and the fighting vehicles are very, very cool. The actual designs are fantastic.
Mm.
So, yeah, I'm looking forward to building that.
Cool.
Hopefully, it's a big box, but reasonably simple to do. Famous last words.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so that's what's coming up.
My bench has been quite busy.
What have you been building?
So I have done a range of little stands for some figureheads. They've been 3D printed and painted and all that sort of stuff.
Ooh.
I've also had a little bit of joy with my 1/32 Helldiver.
Okay.
From Affinity Models. I got a bit very stagnated on it, I've got to be honest, but I have now got some paint on some wings and the fuselage is ready to go, bar a little bit of scratch building I'm going to have to do because the part is not moulded very well. But some progress on that. I've got the Airfix 1/35 Austin K2 Ambulance all put together. I've got, unfortunately, to do a bit of repainting, annoyingly.
Oh, no.
I struggled with the roof on it. I shouldn't have. I must have made an error. I just can't figure out what I did. But anyway, the back section, which is a very thin bit that sort of goes around the edge of the back, for me, played up and really wouldn't stick well. So in a moment of madness, I thought super glue is my best friend. Put some super glue on, placed my two fingers on the roof and my other two fingers on the part and pushed them together. And it was still not really working for me. So I thought, you know what? I got some kicker somewhere. So I used some kicker and lo and behold, I have got two lovely fingerprints in the top of my roof. Luckily, I noticed my mistake pretty quick. However, the damage is done. So, yeah.
Hmm.
Apparently, the K2 didn't have great big clubby fingerprints on the roof.
Oh.
I've sanded them back as best I can. The annoying part is the roof section had been weathered and everything. I got carried away with it before I stuck it all together.
You can fix it. It's just no fun, I guess, isn't it?
Tarpaulin's always your best friend, isn't it?
Oh, don't put a tarp on it, God.
I might do a rolled tarp on the back.
Do you know what would be fun to do one day? It's a tarp group build.
Oh, wouldn't that be good? I like that idea.
Just a load of tarps. Here's my MA Greyhound with a tarp.
In more exciting news, our guest.
Is he still alive in there?
He's nearly finished all the biscuits, which is good because obviously the green M&Ms are still there.
Cool. Well, let's go talk to him.
I'll go and get him out of the room.
Unfurl him. Unchain him from the shackles. Bring him to us.
Drag him in before us.
So this is going to be Robert Lane from Alan 13. It's an interview that we recorded yesterday. We'll hit the play button and we'll see you then in a bit. You were a head teacher?
I was, yes.
Yeah. Wow.
Primary school head teacher.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Were you getting that vibe, James?
Oh, to be honest, it didn't shock me at all.
No?
Oh,
having met you a couple of times, yeah, you've got that aura about you of a head teacher, definitely.
Is that the authority?
Well, no, I didn't run and go and get my lines or anything like that, you know. It was... or pull up a chair next to him and go, I'll sit here until you tell me to go.
What have you done now, James? I did not know that. Well, that's there you go, exclusive for you. Did not know that.
Yeah.
So was it that this was your dream to do, or was it something you?
I decided I didn't want to be a head teacher anymore, and it was I. I don't know if it was a dream to do it, because I was fully aware that when you do something full time that has been a hobby, it stops being a hobby. And therefore you have a very different relationship with it. So in the past, most of my model making, sculpting, was done in the evenings. Now I don't go anywhere near this room in the evenings at all, because it's, it then ends up like a busman's holiday. So it's a different relationship with what is a hobby. It is still, Elan 13 Miniatures is a hobby business. There is no way I could make a living out of doing what I do. So it is a hobby business, but yes, it's different.
So, we've got a list of questions, but, I'm just kind of go freestyle now. Well, is that right with you, James?
Yeah, it was actually a good segue to one of the questions you had, which was, Robert, why don't you tell us what Elan 13 is?
Yeah, okay. Well, on my website, it says a boutique company, which means it's me, basically. I've had a couple of times some of my American customers, they sort of will say, we're over in the UK, could we come over and look at your unit? And you say, well, you can look at the spare room if you want, but it's not very exciting. So it does comprise of this room largely, with some bits stored around the house all over the place. And the bit that you've seen, which is the tray table. This is the hub. The packing goes up. I'm sitting the stocks underneath my legs as I sit here. And that's it. And what I do, what Elan 13 does, is sells figures, mostly military, some science fiction and fantasy. Cast in resin, some 3D work coming in, some accessories. The jet bikes are a new project. And I've been going now for 10 years next year for this Elan 13, and this iteration. It did have a little jaunt out in the 1990s.
So a very important question. As it's a boutique business, do you have a chair in the corner of your spare room that's got like a fluffy, furry cushion?
No, unfortunately, that is an accessory I probably should get, probably branded, though. Yeah, I think it should have an Elan 13 brand on it. But yeah, I could do that.
Isn't that part of the Articles of Association, isn't it? You have to have the chair in the corner when you're
absolutely
making a
boutique company. Yeah. And different teas and coffee probably as well.
Oh, now there's a good segue. A very important question, just to get it out there. Tea and coffee. What is your brew? Is it tea or coffee?
It depends what time of the day, I'm afraid to say. So I'm going to have to sit on the fence here. So I go in order. I have a tea and then a coffee and then a tea and then a coffee. When I was a head teacher, it was coffee. But now it's a mixture of the two.
And the very most important question is, what's the accompaniment that you have with your tea and coffee?
Again, depends on the time of day. Usually a biscuit, possibly a ginger nut. Sorry, is that was the wrong response for this. My apologies.
That was Robert. Thank you very much for joining us.
Are you a Hobnob fan?
I'm not a huge Hobnob fan, no, to be quite honest. Usually the biscuits are shared with the dogs as well. They pester me various bits of those.
I got to say, I am partial to a ginger nut, but only when my dad's over. And my dad loves ginger nuts.
Well, I'm old enough to be your dad, you see, so maybe it's an old person's thing. Yeah.
Oh, maybe.
I'm glad you said that, because ginger nuts I would associate with my dad too. So I'll try and bribe you with some ginger nuts. That's fine. While we're on a roll, what inspired you, or who inspired you, or helped you to start your model making journey?
I think in model making itself, I'm 60 currently, 61 this month. And so my model making started off in the late 60s, early 70s. I always find it amusing that for many people, they always say that's the golden age when everyone can go to the local shop and buy their Airfix or Frog kit, and how marvellous it was, and it'll never be the same again. And I must admit, it was good that you could do that, but the kits were largely awful. I don't see it as a golden age at all. I think actually the age we're in now is a golden age. But I've made everything, aeroplanes, AFVs, spent quite a long time doing that, then went into figures. I'd always played with toy soldiers. I am of that generation that World War II was very close still, and World War I wasn't that far away. Granddad served in World War I, so I am of that generation that still remembers people who were alive that did that. And so that was, everything was based around World War II, largely, that when I started modelling. But that then changed to later historical periods. And so bought figures, would stick them together. In fact, probably the last time I actually was happy with anything I ever made was when I was about 10. Ever since then, it's always been, well, okay, I finished that. Now it should be better, and the next one better be. And so move on like that.
Do you still have that one, Robert?
I mean, my mother might, it's possible, but I doubt it very much. No, I doubt that. But then I started to convert things because I wanted to make something different. I didn't want to do what everybody else was doing. So used the old Airfix collector's figures, started converting those, changing those, did more and more and more conversion. And then went up to teenage. And then you discover other things that aren't anything to do with modelling at all. And stopped.
Well, not plastic anyway, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. stopped then for a bit, went to university. Then not soon after leaving university, which doesn't sound so cool, then actually did go back to it. I went to university in Colchester. There's a very good model club in Colchester, an excellent model club in
there
Colchester.
There is, yeah.
And that was my first time ever going to a club. I'd been to shows before. I'd entered competitions before, but I'd never actually joined a club. And that really helped me, A, realise that I thought I was quite good and realised I wasn't. But there were lots of people there that were really good and would say, well, how about this and try that? And the odd person would say, that's rubbish, you should do it better. But, you know, fortunately, there weren't many of those. And that helped me a lot. So in my sort of early 20s then, carried on with the converting and eventually got to the point where I was making almost everything except for the head. But was still, people would say, oh, have you built that all? No, I didn't build the head. Oh, well, that's a conversion then, isn't it? So then thought, well, okay, bite the bullet, build the head, sculpt the head. So I could then actually say, this is all my own work. And that's how basically go on another, 40 years odd. And that's where I am now. Still trying to sculpt a figure properly.
Still trying.
Yeah, still trying. Yeah, I probably will do it in my grave. That'll be still, he's still trying.
What motivates you with your, because a lot of your stuff is military. So I guess you talked about world wars then. So is that something that inspires you as well? I mean, you're always trying to chase that.
The interest is people. That's right. That's what I like. It's what took me a bit away. I love AFVs, actually. I love looking at AFVs. I must admit, airplanes don't warm to quite so much. I don't know, I've got a stack of World War One ones up there, but I don't make those. But I do, the people, it's sort of, what are they doing? Why are they there? I read a lot of histories and biographies of people. I've got books and books of World War One pilot biographies. And it's sort of what makes them tick. And whenever I sculpt something, I always sculpt the head first, because then you've got the person to start with. The rest of it could be anybody really, but you've got that character there to start. That gives me the inspiration, the spur, whatever, to push on with it and get it done.
Yeah. Wow. I like that.
So once you just interested in that, you start with the head. Does that mean that the facial figures that you've put in there are already channeling the way the body might be in its, what it's trying to say in the figure?
It needs to do that. Yeah. So when I'll have already in my mind what the figure's going to be doing, and what it's going to be wearing. I've done the research on it. So I know if it's a uniform, or even if it's a sci-fi piece, you're still going to do your research. I think there's this myth sort of, if you're doing fantasy or sci-fi, you can do anything. They've all got their own codes and their own things that actually you have to sort of try, and the parameters that you've got to work within. And so, yeah, I know what the figure, I know that the pose and the stance that's going to be. Usually, before I even get any clay or putty out, I try and get photographs of myself in the pose. There's a couple of those on the Facebook page. I'm invading the patio or something like that. That's the best way to do it, because my wife's very, very long suffering and will take the 360 degree photographs of me. You get it from all angles, and that's the advantage. If I have got clothing that's the same weight, I don't have a huge stock of uniforms and things like that. But if I've got something that's the same weight, so if I'm doing something in a thick coat, I'll put a coat on just to see how the folds go as well. So even though it may not be the same thing, it gives you that idea of how it is. You can't always do that. And some poses you can't replicate without instantly falling over. But which would provide humour for my wife. So I try and do that. And that does help with proportion, because I'm not trained. So I have to work at proportion. In sculpting, everything is about proportion. And I do have to work at it. And I get it wrong sometimes. I get it wrong sometimes.
That's interesting that you make your own reference.
If it's a uniform, I'll reference the uniform so I know what it is and how it looks and try and get... When I first started, it used to matter a bit more than... Both of you may disagree with me on that, but I think that, you know, I remember not sculpting a figure because I didn't have a rear view of it or I didn't know what the cuff flap looked like. Whereas now I think, well, I've done the research I'm going to do. That's as much as I'm ever going to find out. I'll just do it. And I think that's important. I think I can understand with aircraft and with AFVs, it's got to be as accurate as it possibly can. And I think increasingly with figures, there's a bit more leeway. I don't think figure modelers now are as bothered about is something absolutely accurate. They just want it to look nice.
The frontal proportion of it or style of it matters because that gives you the basis of what's around. But I've always said the same with diorama making, that if you use a reference, if you stand 2 foot either way, it'll be a different picture. It's almost impossible to get the whole surround correct, in my mind anyway. I can totally understand where you're going with the figure side of it, as long as it works as a whole piece.
Yeah. So you have a viewpoint. That's the same when I'm making my models. I have to consider where people look at it from, and so I don't bother painting the other side.
Yeah, it doesn't paint underneath tanks.
I've seen in competitions box art beautifully painted that isn't painted on the back. Then the person who enter it wonders why they don't get a medal. But I've seen that at Euromilitair. Yeah.
Do you paint the soles of the shoes? That's the question.
So absolutely. Yeah, yeah, oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. No, I don't.
Well, that was one of the questions I had, actually. Do you get to paint much these days?
I must admit that painting is my least favourite part. I know for most people, painting is the bit they like most, but I've always found the least enjoyable. It's the sculpting bit that rings my bell rather than the painting. But I do paint sometimes. Usually, if I've sculpted a figure I don't know if it's going to sell, I'll paint it because at least I haven't got to pay a box artist to do it. I've got a guy called Edward Sage who does a lot of my box art. He's good and he's pretty quick. I can give him some reference and he'll get the thing back to me. To be honest, I take twice as long to paint anything as I do to sculpt it, because I paint it and then look at it and then hate it and then paint it again and look at it and hate it and paint it again. Whereas with sculpting, I can get myself to a point where I think, no, I've actually got to get this done now and get it finished.
So you have somebody paint miniatures for the box art. Do you stick with one person so that they have a style that goes with your brand?
Sort of. I stick with Edward because he's a nice guy and he's good at it. But I have used other box artists. I've used quite a few. And sometimes you're right. I have got some of the older stuff I've had done by other people. And it does jar a bit sometimes with the rest of it. But I think it does depend on what you're doing. The jet bike that you've got, Malcolm, was painted by two different people. The actual figure, it was painted by Edward, and then the bike itself was painted by Mike Holloway, who used to run Reheat Models, because Edward doesn't paint vehicles. Painting does make a lot of difference. I'm quite often, I'm afraid, very disparaging of painters, as in it's all colouring painting by numbers. But that's actually not quite true. I'm being a little unfair there. You could see that bike painted by a different person, certainly by some of the fantasy guys who really push the tone. You know, they really do push that contrast and the depth of colour, and it would look totally different. Or by an AFV modeler who really goes into chipping and some heavy weathering on it. And again, it would look totally different and would look brilliant. I do fully appreciate paint can make or break something, absolutely.
Got you.
Made the base on that particular box art?
Mike did that. Yeah, he did that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll put a picture up on the Facebook page when we release the podcast, so people can see what we talk about this jet bike. One thing I wanted to talk to you about was jet bikes. I know that I think I spoke to you about 6 months ago, and you had floated the idea that there was going to be another jet bike coming out.
Yep.
And I was very interested in that. And I think I saw on your Facebook page only hours ago that there was a new jet bike going to be coming out for Telford.
Yes, very hopefully that there will be. This is number 3 rather than number 2. Number 2 still hasn't arrived yet, but this is number 3. This is a different digital producer, sculptor than I've used for the first one, who I've known for a long time. So we actually worked together, sat down. I showed him some pictures, the sort of thing I wanted, and he got that out pretty quickly. He had that done within a month. Wow. And, you know, tweaked. And that's one of the joys of digital work, is that you can tweak it. Not easily. I think, I mean, I always go there very respectfully. A guy called Tim Perry, I've worked with him before. And I think sometimes, if like me, you don't understand some of the CAD stuff that he's doing, I can say, oh, well, just change that, 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 and that bit. And actually you're asking him to do 10 hours work. I say to him, can you do that? But will it be easy or not? So I think that relationship is vital. It's like when I'm doing a commission piece and somebody says, oh, can you just repose that leg? Well, yeah, I can, but it means almost totally resculpting something if that's what you want, which you told me earlier. You have to understand that. That's ready. It's at the caster. So Tim designed it, sent me a couple of 3D prints. Then I spent several hours of joy. A fantastic cattail.
this is what I meant by sudden intrusions. It does look like a brontosaurus. It's a cat.
I'll be honest. It just looks like a towel that he's moving it across the screen for comedy effect. Yeah,
it's my little feather duster. I keep when I have guests.
James, I know you've used you do printing, don't you?
I do, yeah.
And the resin, rubbing that resin down is foul. It's horrible stuff because it's so fine, the dust on it. Yep. I really, of all the stuff you've got to rub down, I hate doing that. So a few days of rubbing that down, it then goes off to the caster. The photos on the website at the moment is one of the early production ones, so it's a bit different from that. But I did sculpt the figure, though I have put it done by my good friend Roberto Rue. And that's my sci-fi nom de plume. And the only reason for that, and it's obviously not particularly secret because I've just put it out to your millions of listeners, that I once had a guy who came up to me and said, oh, I quite like your work, but you don't do fantasy, do you? I'm a sculpting whore. I'll do anything. You know, if you want it sculpted, I'll sculpt it. So I thought, well, okay, if I'm not thought of that, I can do that. And Roberto Rue does all the fantasy stuff. He smokes lots of Gauloises and drinks lots of coffee and it just eats biscuits. But that's,
Wow.
So you work with a lot of people. How much do you value that relationship with them?
It's very important working in this environment. Time, I was used to people working to time and working quickly, and I find that also somehow managed to slip out of that mode. But also those that you're working with, a lot of them aren't full-time. Some are, but most of them aren't. And so you have to accept that you start a project that you hope will be done in 3 months, and 2 years later, you might still be working on it. But I do think you do need a relationship. And I have, while I do most of the sculpting for the Elan 13 range, I have got other sculptors that work with me on that. They always do something they want to do. I don't say, can you go and do this, please? I will have a chat with them. So Mike Blank, who has done some work for me, he comes up with, I'd like to do this. And I go, yeah, okay, Mike. And he goes off and does it. And Ian Sakamura does some of my sculpting. Again, it's very much, what do you want to do, Ian? And he does that. Because if they do that, they'll do something they want. They'll probably do it a bit quicker. But they'll also put their enthusiasm into it rather than me saying, go and do that. Because I know that from doing commission work. Some of it is great. And some of it, you think, well, I'll do this because it's paying me some money. But I have zero interest in it. But I'll get it done.
It's the relationship of the sculptor and the piece, isn't it? You know, if they want to do something, then that relationship will be full of love, effort and joy.
Yeah.
If it's not, it's a case of just banging it out for work. And then that relationship can quite easily break down.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's the same with anything, isn't it? You've got someone building your conservatory. If you've asked to design it from scratch, he's going to want to finish it off and make it his own. So he's going to love it like it is his own.
Mm.
You know, so you can get a lot more out of an artist if you just let them be.
A tangent to a degree, I suppose, but also a segue in something you said. 3D sculpting, scanning versus handmade.
Tim, who does the 3D design for me, he doesn't do sculpting. He can't do that. He has no interest in doing that. He does you know, designs that are vehicles and things. He's shown me all the stuff, and I've taken notes and I've sat down. It doesn't interest me at all. It really doesn't. If I was a young up-and-coming sculptor, I'd have to 3D sculpt now. That is the way it's going. That is where the market will go. I think that the traditional sculpting will continue and there will always be a need for it. But if you wanted to do commercial work, it's definitely 3D sculpting. I was talking to a guy a few years ago who worked in the jewellery business, and he said for anything figurative, it's 3D now. There's hardly anything done by hand. And he'd learned how to do it. And I do think that the best 3D sculptors are ones who have been sculptors before. And I think you're seeing more and more, and that's why I think it's actually got better. When it first came out, there were a lot of blank looking faces. And now it's coming that there's some fantastic work. So I'm not a Luddite that thinks that 3D work is terrible. I think it's good. I think scanning, I find that a different thing. The concept of scanning, and I had several people came up and almost with glee said, oh, you won't be needed soon, will you? Because, you just be able to scan someone and I can print it out on my printer. First person who said that to me was at least 4 years ago. Yet to see someone who has actually done that and produced anything that looks any good. You've got some of the big companies who are, the Tamiya stuff is human scanned. Is it Redoke do that as well? But you've got to get the uniform or the kit or the thing that the person's wearing. Yeah. And you've got to have a model to do it. And unfortunately, most of these guys who came to say that to me were fat and middle-aged. And unfortunately, if you're wanting to model most people who are in service, they aren't fat and middle-aged anymore. And so that doesn't quite work. The only other thing with scanning is that if you're scanning direct from a human and you're then reducing it down, and it happens a lot with sort of aircraft and AFV stuff. There is stuff, and it does look lovely. It's harder to paint, though, I think, because a human face reduced is fairly featureless. And if you blew up the stuff that I do, it would look like a gargoyle, if it was blown up to a huge scale, because I accentuate the features to make it stand out and actually makes it easier to paint. Yeah. And I was talking to a guy, Gordon Mitchell, about he gets a lot of things for his range, which he'll have a sculptor sculpt it for him, and then he'll offer it in many scales. But the advantage he's got is that the sculptor will adapt the thing for the scale. And I think where that doesn't happen, and in the early days of digital work, you get your 28 mil figure, your 54 mil figure, and maybe 120 mil figure, all the same thing blown up. And it looked good in one scale and looked over detailed in the small scale and lacking detail in the big scale. And it still happens a bit. You see that sometimes. It's the future, as in it's new, but I don't think it's the future that's taking over entirely. Again, I get people saying, people will just print and you won't be needed. A lot of people don't want to print. And printing isn't just pressing a button. I mean, you'll know that, James. It's actually, you've got to set it up. It's got to be right. There's cleaning up afterwards. You've got to cure it off. It's not like it's just, here's the photocopier, press the button, and 2 minutes later, I've got something I can paint. And I think even now, some people still think that's what it's like.
It's a tool, isn't it? If you use it as a tool to make things with, whatever that might be. So I guess the answer to that question then, James, would be all of them, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I see value in them all. Absolutely. They've all got fantastic value, and there is superb work in all sorts. There's some brilliant digital sculptors out there. And there are some things, if you're doing chainmail, digitally, you could do that far better than you can ever do it by hand, particularly in small scales, just because you can do it bigger and reduce it down. I have huge respect for those who work digitally. There were arguments before in competitions whether a digital sculptor can enter into a sculpted piece because it's not sculpting. Well, yeah, it is. It's incredibly difficult. So it is sculpting because you've got to have an understanding of how the thing works and the proportions are to be able to do it.
Also with that is I am completely useless with CAD. I've got no idea. I have a friend that's really good. While he was doing work, he did things in a bigger form because it was easier, and then shrank it down and then adjusted things a lot along the way. Like you noted earlier, that you say, can you just do this? And it's not just, there you go, done. It's a lot more technically involved in the design and putting it together.
So it's bizarre how sometimes it is, and that the new hover bike, initially, it was designed because the bike gang are supposed to be like a Pony Express service in some dystopian future. The original front end of that bike was designed like a horse. And I said to Tim, I don't actually like that. So he said, I could do that. And he just turned the whole thing round. And it looks like it does now. And I thought, well, how do you manage to do that? Because that was easy to do. Yet something small can be really hard to do.
Mm. Oh, that's interesting. Well, one of the things you touched on, you're saying about the different scales, when you're sculpting different scales, you seem to work in just the 1/48 sort of size. Is that right?
The smallest I do these days is 48. So, 48, 32nd and 24th are usually. 24. I mean, I do busts as well. So go out. And I did have to do a 1/8 scale World War I pilot for a commission that went over to the States. Last year or the year before. That was an interesting little thing, because you get used to scales, you get used to size.
That's what I was going to say. Favorite scale that you prefer to
I'm
do?
Probably most used to 32nd scale because that's I've done more figures in that scale. So you can it sort of falls naturally. But on my bench, I have a 75 mil, a couple of 75 mil figures. I have some 32nd scale figures, all sculpted by Mike Good, because I think he's a brilliant sculptor. So I have his work there. I use that scale reference all the time just to check I've got it right. And I got a couple of digitally printed out things as well, again, by Tim, just mannequin things. But full figures in those two scales, again, just to make sure the proportions are right.
Oh, okay.
That's interesting. With the figures you've got on the bench there that you're using as reference for scale, does that also come across in some of the figures that you choose to do, that where you've seen other sculptors work and thought, oh, I like how I've done that. I'd really like to try that.
Yeah, I very much look at other people's work. And yeah, I've ripped off that pair of legs or how that person's got the arm or how that person's got the expression on the face. Very much so. Not used their piece, but copied it to get it because I just think it looks good. Yeah, I mean, I don't have a huge grey army at all. I've got books everywhere. I mean, this is a tiny proportion of the books I've got. But I don't have a lot of boxes of models because I don't tend to buy them. I am useless for the trade. I go to a model show and if I'm lucky, I come back with one of those rubber tip sculpting tools, which has cost me £2. And that's about it. If I see a piece of work I really like sculpted, I will sometimes buy that just to have it and look at it and mull it over. And particularly there's a few, I've got a couple of female heads sculpted by two different sculptors. And I can't remember the names. One's this French guy. They're both French guys, I think. Beautifully sculpted. And they're just great reference for just because it's 3D and you can turn it round and how does that work and how are those proportions work. So I do use that. When people say about, oh, how do you do sculpting? I always say, well, get reference. I think the trouble with people sculpting humans is they think they know what a human looks like because they look at one in the mirror, but they never do. You never really look at yourself and you don't really look at how your face works. And so that's something that I always say, start with something, copy something rather than try and do something out of nothing. Just copy something that you like, because then you're better to get the proportions right as well. But, you know, and look, you know, just really look at something. What does it look like? Take photographs of it and look at it.
There's a difference between looking and seeing, isn't there?
Absolutely. Yeah. When I get a box art back from Edward, and he'll have done a lovely job on it, it'll look great. And all I'll look at is, well, that bit sculpted wrong. And I got that sculpting wrong, didn't I? There, and the proportions are wrong on that. So the whole thing's ruined for me entirely.
You know it back to front, inside out and upside down, don't you? Yeah. And someone else wouldn't, because they wouldn't have spent that intimate time that you spent with it.
It's a trait of model makers as well. You know, the amount of times I listen to model makers saying, you say to them, oh, that looks really great. You've done really good. Oh, no, there's lots of mistakes. Well, I can't see none. Well, yeah, but I can point them out to you. Oh, don't do that.
No.
Because you don't need to. It looks great.
But it's also what makes you do it better. And I have no criticism, however, anybody does their model maker. I don't care. Whatever they do and they enjoy doing is as far as I'm concerned, absolutely great. Even paper modelling, I'm afraid, gentlemen.
Hang on, what's going on here? We're being abused.
I do think that I almost envy those guys that do the Rose of Shermans or the Rose of Spitfires that have been painted over a 30-year period and the first one looks exactly the same as the last one, but they're just really happy. They've got every mark of it out. There is no development in their modeling skill because they don't care. That's not what they're doing it for. It's a representation. And I envy that sometimes because, as I say, I have to do better next time.
That's interesting. There's a difference between people making models so that they can have a model of the thing in their house, which is what I tend to be. And then there's people who want to finesse the skill of modeling and be better and better and better. And I think sometimes there's crossover, sometimes they don't, but they all occupy the same hobby space.
Yeah. You know? What is great about our hobby is it's very diverse. Yeah, there's lots of different ways of doing it. And I think, and that's great to celebrate that. I think, unfortunately, you know, people get picky with each other sometimes because people don't do it the same way as they do. I've heard of sculptors who, if they see someone who's done their work and they've painted it badly, they don't like it. If someone's painted anything that I've done and they come and show it to me at a show or they posted it up on Facebook, I just think that's marvelous. They've paid me some money. More importantly, they've spent their time, their emotion, creating this thing. And you just think, how fantastic is that? That something I've actually made they've wanted to put that love into, absolutely marvellous. I can't think of any better approval that you can ever get from someone. And I think it's great. I don't mind whether they've, you know, done it with that brush that you paint the wall with or not. It's just that they've done that in the way they want to do it. It's marvellous.
Yeah. Mm. That must be an amazing feeling, something you possibly can't buy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes, absolutely. Wow. Yeah, and it's very different from just doing it for yourself or sticking it in a competition. That is because, you know, somebody else has interpreted it.
Mm, I hadn't thought of that at all. That's interesting. What's your least favourite thing to sculpt? If you got a commission, are there things that you wouldn't do?
Yes, probably. I don't. There's a few subjects I wouldn't do. I would steer clear of because I don't feel comfortable doing them. Not because of how they are, what they look like, just because of what they represent. Otherwise, no, I'll have a go at anything. Again, it's on the Facebook. A guy wanted me to do the Russian, it's a very Art Deco figure, the Sputnik figure in a Russian air museum, which is a sort of very Art Deco figure holding the Sputnik satellite in her hand. And it was totally sculptural. And I looked at that and thought, oh, my God. And he wanted it quite big, not huge, but sort of bigger than probably 12th scale, something like that. And I thought, how on earth am I going to do that? But it was great. And then I had to paint it bronze. That was a huge struggle. And the problem more with that is, I think perhaps my most difficult is when people want something that's an exact copy of something or as near as possible. I'm happy doing an interpretation, but some people just want that, which is fine. I understand why they want that. And that's why they're paying me to do it. That can be a little frustrating sometimes.
Have you ever found with that, though, that when someone says they want a copy, that they don't actually want a copy, they want what they see in their mind as a copy? Yeah. Because it's always different, isn't it? I find that all the time with people, is that when you talk about things, you were saying earlier about we never watch ourselves properly or people, you know, how they move and all that. I'm very much a people watcher. I love to watch people and pick up all their personal attributes and all that sort of thing. It's something I learned at college and always fascinated me. So, and I found that a few times where someone said, I really want to make a copy of that. And they make it and they're like, oh, it's not what I wanted. And it's purely because what's in their head is not a copy. It is an interpretation of what they've seen.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree entirely. Yes, we do see things differently. So, yeah, and I'm absolutely with you on the people thing. I now, if I'm staring at people, I can say, oh, yes, I'm looking for sculpting reference. But, I agree with it. I love watching people and watching how they stand and the way where they interact with each other. I think it's great. And I think that is in diorama work particularly is so important to get that done. I think that, you know, over the years, how dioramas have changed from a vehicle, an aircraft with some people on it to actually now to have a successful diorama, it's got to have people who are interacting with each other. Otherwise, it doesn't work. Otherwise, it's just a tank with people. It's not a diorama.
It's the hardest part, really is the hardest part. And it's the one thing I find incredibly difficult because I'm not a sculptor and I have probably manipulated a figure or two in my modelling journey. And the poses that you get in kits and stuff aren't what I want.
Yeah.
So I get very frustrated because I'm looking. The only way I can describe it is I've got my two action men and I'm trying to get them to look at each other in the right form. It's really, really difficult. So
I think if you look at the work of someone like Peter Usher and the stuff that he does. And that, you know, the things really do interact with each other. And I mean, he does a lot of conversion of the figures. He does quite a lot of it is sculpted. But that sort of stuff, it really works. There's the whole thought process of how I want this to work. And then actually getting it. And I think that is really, really skillful, but also needs that emotion put into it as well to make the scene work. To me, diorama work is the sort of pinnacle of what, it doesn't matter what the diorama's of, but in that sort of work, to make it work and to have it done well is the pinnacle, I think, of our hobby.
Yeah, I'm a big fanboy of Peter Usher. On my first entrance to Telford on a competition, I asked his opinion on what I'd done. It was my first effort. I was very happy with what I did. It was the best I'd done up to that point. One of the things he said was, look at the way the figures are interacting with each other. Well, you've got a figure there that doesn't make sense. It confuses the story. And at the time, I was like, oh, well, thanks very much for the comments. And, you know, went home and was like, I haven't got a clue what you meant. Not a clue. And then after quite a while of thinking about it, I suddenly dawned on me what he was saying. Because obviously, I got the personal investment in that diorama. So I understood the story because I wrote it.
Mm.
So it made perfect sense to me. But I hadn't stepped back and taken a different viewpoint, i.e. someone else's viewpoint, as to whether they'd follow what I'd done. And I think he's, in fairness, I think he's instrumental in the fact that the next time I entered the competition, I won something.
Feedback is really important for getting better. I also find feedback, judging feedback or what people actually want. Most people don't want feedback. They say they do, but they just want you to say it looks fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't really want to be told anything to improve on it. And it's very difficult, I think, like you did, James, coming with something that's complete and asking for feedback, because it's quite difficult then, because if you're saying, well, actually, if you've done that or done that, but you're not going to do that now because you've done it. Many, many years ago, there was a forum called The Basement, which was largely figure modeling forum, but not entirely. And that was based around giving feedback. And it could be quite brutal sometimes as well.
Uh-huh.
And some people really didn't like it. I suppose a bit like the Scale Modelers Critique Group on Facebook now. Some people just couldn't cope with critical feedback. And that, not nasty, but critical. And some people really didn't like that and really were quite against it. But it does help you get better. I entered a bust at Euromilitaire, again, a long, long time ago. And it didn't get anything. One of the top figure sculptors at the time, I'm not going to say who, he judged it. And I said, oh, what could be better deal? Why didn't it win anything? And he ripped it to absolute shreds. I walked back feeling about 6 inches shorter than I did when I handed it to him. But it didn't half make me improve my work afterwards. It really did. It sunk. And I thought, right, okay, he knows what he's talking about. And, you know, the next piece I did was a lot better because I listened to what he said. But it can be difficult sometimes. And as I say, I think a lot of people don't really want that, which is absolutely fair enough. People show me stuff on the stand and, you know, they don't want me to say, oh, actually, if you've done that a bit, but they want me just to say, yeah, it looks great. Well done.
That's quite interesting because at the moment, it's a bit of a hot topic about model shows and competitions. And there's some feedback that's come via the States that if possible to offer that a critique feedback is given for what you've done. What do you think about that? Do you think that's a good idea?
It's a great idea in theory. I know I've heard Will Patterson talk about it. And it is, I absolutely think that certainly if it's a 2-day show or if things are judged in the morning, judges should go around with a badge on that says they're a judge. So that if somebody wants to ask them if they judge their class, oh, well, what could you tell me? Whatever. I think judges should give feedback. From my own personal experience, judging at Euromilitaire, when you'd start in the afternoon and you'd finish at 9 o'clock at night, if you'd only judged a small category of maybe 20 things, then yes, you probably could do that. But if you were judging, you know, a busts class with, you know, 150 entries in it, you just couldn't. I think the thing I think you might struggle with is to get judges, because, you know, getting judges is tough at any model show usually. I know that one of the theories is you just have a tick sheet with, I don't know how helpful that would be. Maybe it would. I'm not quite sure how a tick sheet would help you. I mean, okay, if things like alignment, you could tick yes, well, aligned or not aligned, that would tell you that. But I'm not sure on some of the other things whether ticking a box would tell the person enough for it to be helpful.
Yeah.
I think the feedback's got to be of use to someone.
Yeah, absolutely.
If they want it. Otherwise, I'm not sure. So I have mixed feelings. I absolutely agree. If you can get feedback or have a system devised to give feedback, I think it's a good idea. Largely, it's only ever going to be at the major shows because, to be quite honest, as we all know, at most local shows, the judging is done by whoever's walking past the chief judge at the time and can be nabbed to go and do it. And the standard is weird and wild and wonderful. And if it's big and colourful, it usually beats everything else. At a bigger show where you have got judges who generally know what they're talking about, I think they can give feedback. But the mechanism, I do think, is still a problem.
I was grabbed to do some judging at a small show. The experience of doing it was nerve-wracking for me because I knew, interestingly enough, one of the guys had actually put a figure in. It was an 13 figure in the competition. I was judging the commercial vehicles. It was, yeah, it was just nerve-wracking because I knew I like to look at what pleases me to see and what technical things are difficult to pull off and hide, you know, hiding glue marks and hiding your PVA and all that kind of stuff. Some things are tricky and then some other things are easy. And I got to a point where I had two and I had to choose the best one out of these six. I got two and they were completely different. One was a tractor, right? Okay. One, and I like tractors. And one was a pickup truck. And I thought, I can't choose a tractor because I like tractors. That's not very professional. So I'll choose a pickup truck. But I can't just choose a pickup truck because I like tractors. So what it came down to was the scale of the leaves. One person had, they'd put tea leaves on as leaves. Okay. Other person had used the Green Stuff World stamper to make the leaves and they just looked at scale. So I just, well, that one's out and that's the reason. So if someone come back to me and said, why did you not choose mine? I'd have to say it was because your leaves were too big. And that's it. That was what it was.
Yeah. And I think that is the disadvantage of the 1-2-3 system. Often when I've been judging, there'll be three or four pieces that are equally as good as each other. And you're really just picking out the minutiae to get the what's different. Yeah. And they all deserve to get that same award. And the other thing, which I do think is important, is that if you, like at Telford, and I'm not knocking Telford, I love Telford, so this is not knocking it at all, but or an IPMS show or a Games Workshop show, let's Games Day is exactly the same. If you enter for years and you're not getting anything, you've no idea if your stuff's better than it was 5 years ago to now. It might be. Yeah. And actually, you know, in the first year, you might have been way down the list. That in the fifth year, you might have been fourth. But you've got no idea whether you're making any progress from that system. Whereas, you know, if you've got a bronze medal and then, you know, a couple of years later, you get a silver maybe or whatever, or you go back to bronze. That certainly happened to me. That gives an indication of how you are progressing as a modeler. To me, that's important, but I'm laissez-faire. People can use the system they want to use.
I think you're right. We remarked upon Golden Demon Award this year. I can't remember how long he'd been doing it for. Malcolm, you'll remember.
1986. And only this year has he won. So obviously,
is this the Slayer Sword? Is this Chris Clayton?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know Chris. He's a lovely guy.
But it's the first time he's actually won the sword.
Yeah.
And there was an interview. So how long have you been entering? Oh, 1986. What? Right, well, I better get started. That's why I thought to myself, it's going to take me a while.
I know Chris quite well, and he's a lovely, lovely guy, and is a brilliant sculptor, equally as good painter, and also has the accolade of being the first person painting sci-fi or fantasy to get Best of Show at Euromilitair as well, which was a huge move to get that recognised. I was really glad he got the Slayer Sword. It was, yeah, well deserved.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure I put the picture up. The piece that he won with was just amazing. Absolutely amazing. Who do you admire then? Who's your modelling god?
Well, in all respects, lots of people, unfortunately. I think that going back, I don't know if you're too young, Malcolm, definitely. And I think, James, you are as well. Do you remember Sid Horton, the Airfix magazine, when it was a tiny little publication? Sid Horton, who then went on to do Chota Sahib, and he then worked for Verlinden. He was a brilliant sculptor. And when I was young, I followed his work. I thought he was superb. I've mentioned Mike Good. I mean, Mike Good doesn't do a lot for figure modelling these days, but he's a brilliant sculptor. Mike Blank, who does some work for me, but I've liked his work forever. And his work is so original. I mean, the way he paints stuff, nobody else paints like that. And again, talking about diorama work, the way he gets figures to interact and uses light within the painting to emphasize that as well. It's not just posing, it's actually using the whole effect. He's brilliant. Maren van Gels, again, he's a lovely chap. If you ask me to pick out the best piece I've ever seen, but his Frank Zappa. It's one figure, but it's Frank Zappa jumping. So it's lots of figures go into each other. I remember seeing that in the competition and thinking, my God, that's fantastic. Not only the imagination to be able to execute it is just stunning. So him, Chris Clayton, definitely. Raoul Latour, I think he's a brilliant sculptor who went from physical sculpting into doing some digital, very little now. You know, they're very good. So I wouldn't have said one is the God. There's lots of people that do some just fantastic work. And Bill Horan, of course, Again, diorama work, but individual figures. He put life into figures. He brought the figure modelling community on leaps and bounds with his military modelling articles he used to do. I know I will never get to be anywhere near as good as them. I one year, Marion van Gels, he did a piece called Van Gels Construction, and it was a Scots figure. It was only 54 mil, and he had it. It was like it was being carved out of rock, and he'd done tiny little figures that were next. I think it got Best of Show. It certainly got a gold, and everyone was falling all over it. And there were pictures of it everywhere. And I had a fairly crude figure of an old guy holding his grandson's hand, standing in front of a war memorial, which I'd entered in that class. But his elbow was in everybody's photograph, this guy. So that figure's elbow has been photographed more than anything else I've ever done.
That's your claim to fame.
Yeah,
I love that.
We've talked about that before in podcasts, haven't we?
It's all about
where you put your thing on your competition.
Absolutely.
Table.
Yeah. If you time it right, so you're not quite the last one, but you can go on there and find whichever the one that you think is the best and put yours next to it, because at least it'll be next to a medal. That's my goal.
Yeah, World Expo this year, I mean, it was just madness putting the stuff up. There were so many things entered. You just had to try and desperately carve a little space to put your entry in. It was fantastic. It was brilliant, and I'm really glad I went, but you couldn't look at it all. There was just so much stuff. I've seen most of it on the internet now, because at the time it was just like this wall of fantastic work, and it was overkill for your senses.
Gotcha.
But a brilliant show, really well organized.
So skipping back to the way you do things, what would be your favorite tool?
Oh, I think it would be the rubber-tipped clay pusher, or high-tech tool of a pin with the top of it cut off in an X-Acto handle. Those two, and I've got a probe that came out of a microscope that I was given when I was about eight, that is all bent in different shapes now, and I use that just for stuff for prodding clay and putty about. So there's nothing high-tech. I have got into using proper sanding stuff now, and I do like that. But yeah, nothing high tech at all about
that. So it's handmade tools as well as...
I do have some handmade tools that I've made, yeah.
That's interesting.
That is.
Yeah.
My favourite tool is the Bees Putty clay that I use. That's my favourite.
Is that what you use to sculpt?
That's what I use for a lot of it, yeah. It's an oven hardening clay that doesn't go off normally. You have to bake it. And the joy of that is that you can just keep reworking it. The disadvantage of that is that you do just keep reworking it. but it is, and that certainly for me brought my sculpting on a lot, because the if you working in epoxy putty, and I do a lot of work in epoxy putty still, but it's such a pain to have to change something when it's gone off and it's hardened, whereas in clay you can just remaneuver it about. It takes moments, and it's much from that point of view I love it.
Do you have a shelf of doom?
No, I don't actually, largely because I can't. Because if you're doing commission work, you've got to get it done. You can't just sort of say, well, I'm fed up with this one now, I'm not going to do it. So it has to get done. And if I've got to put stuff in my range, it needs to go in the range. I need to get it finished. So generally, I understand shelf of dooms. And I had quite a long break from model making, got fed up with it. And I re-entered it about 2006. And when I came back in 2006, it took me several years to finish anything, because I just not be quite happy with it. And I do a bit and no, I'd leave that one. I'll try the next one. I do a bit. But I actually found finishing stuff was a good thing, because if you don't finish stuff, you don't really get better. You improve bits, but you don't get... I'm not saying you should finish everything, but you do need to finish stuff. The Elan motto is made with love, swearing and throwing things about. And I have thrown things about. My wife reminds me regularly of the time when I'd had a back operation. And so I was off work for quite a few weeks with that. And I got to the point where I could go upstairs and do some sculpting, and I was sculpting something. I was a bust, and I got so cross with it. I just hurled it across the room and it smacked into the wall, and I fell off the chair I was on, which is a really intelligent thing to do when you've just had back surgery. So yeah, she reminds me of that.
I love that. That's brilliant.
Does your wife get involved in it?
She is incredibly long-suffering about it, lets me get on with it, and lets me go to lots of model shows, and which is at weekends when she's off because she's at work during the week. And from that point of view, yes, she helps with being you know, if I ask her to look at something, and she's very good at, I ask her to look, yeah, and of course she gets the worst of it. Oh, what do you think that needs changing? Yes. Well, you mean it needs changing? Oh, you mean if I've got to change it, I've got to do this, I've got to do this. Well, you did ask. So, but she is great with that. So yeah, she's just incredibly supportive with it all.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, without her, I couldn't be doing it.
Right. Yeah. Behind every good modeler is a good woman.
Well, a good person.
Mm-hmm. Or a dog. Yeah.
Or a cat.
Yeah. Cats and dogs bring their own problems.
Saying about one of the most difficult things I ever had to do, I had to do Jimmy Page, and it was in 32nd scale, and he was using his twin neck guitar, and so I had to sculpt that. And that was hard work. And I strung it with our dog's hair, yeah, hairs from the dog. But God, that was hard work. And the hair kept stretching. So you'd think, oh, it's done. And then it would stretch a bit more. So then the strings became loose. So you'd have to do it again. And that was just absolutely infuriating.
What type of dog was it?
King Charles Spaniels, Cavalier King Charles Spaniels. So
I was just about to say, was it voluntary given?
No. It was me with a pair of scissors.
Did he tell him to go, do you know what you need for that string? I got some of this. Have that.
Absolutely.
That's my critic of the day, Dad. See you later.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. It reminds me of the story I heard about modelers in days gone by. If they were trying to build a thatched roof, would go and find a young lady with long blonde hair and trim them so that they could use that hair for their thatched roofs. A Penton Museum, it's a museum of railway layouts. They have a video of a guy saying, yes, we have to curb people's enthusiasm when it comes to chasing young girls around with scissors. Yeah, you do.
Yeah. That's an assault charge.
I do actually know a railway modeler that's done just that, but... Yeah.
With permission, I hope.
Well, I don't know.
I remember going to a British Model Soldier Society show donkeys years ago with my mother, so it shows how old it was. And it was in central London, and we went, and I was seeing all this marvellous work. And I said to one guy, oh, how did you do the base of that? He said, oh yes, I use stubble. Yeah, I thought, well, I don't even shave yet. I went, well, how am I supposed to use stubble? But yeah, that was not overly helpful information.
Natural flocking.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Blood, sweat, tears, and hair all going into your models. Yeah. Yeah.
I must go and clean my plug hole.
Yeah.
I heard it here first.
So let's move on to something a bit more friendly. So would you say you prefer full figures or busts?
I do more full figures. I like both because in a bust you can really go to town with a head. And that is the big thing. You've got to get that right. If you don't get that right, you might as well give up and go home with that one. So I like doing both, but I do tend to do more full figures. And I've just done a bust which has just been released, but I do tend to do more full figures.
Is that the hippie guy?
Yes. Yeah, Wilf. Yeah.
Wilf. Oh, is there? Oh, if he's named, is there another one to go with him then?
There's supposed to be an Old Guys with Style series. I come up with lots of series, and they tend to get one released, and that's about it. there was the well-known Crimean War VC series, which still has one 3 years after I released the first one. But yeah, that will be. There are two more that are already sculpted of that, which will come out at some point. But yeah. Yeah, Will's sort of supposed to be slightly cartoony. But that's him.
Yeah,
you can do anything with him.
Yeah, I guess you can write anything on that placard.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what model are you most proud of?
Probably none of them, if I'm honest, because I see things wrong with all of them. I suppose I should say the first model I ever got a gold medal at Euromilitaire with. And that was a source of enormous frustration for my wife, because I've been going on for years about, I want to get a gold medal. I want to get a gold medal. I had friends that had got gold medal. Why am I going to get a gold medal? And I got one eventually. And that was working with Edward. I sculpted it. He painted it. And I got it. And of course, and I phoned my wife up and said, I got a gold medal. Great. And she said, aren't you really happy? Well, yeah, I got a gold medal now. And it was okay. Now move on to the next thing. And I can see that was really annoying. So I don't think there's anything I'm particularly proud of. I don't have any of my stuff around. There is a display cabinet in one of the other rooms but it's an upstairs room people don't go into. And some of those are things that people have given me from my friends who've got work that are lovely. So they're not mine. But I don't have them around at all. If I think if I yeah, there's boxes full of the stuff that I take to the shows as display. Yeah. But I think if I didn't do that, I wouldn't keep them. I don't have much interest in them once they're done.
So talking about your gold medal for a second, just as a personal interest, really, when you got your gold medal, did that affect your next model at all in any way? Did it your inspiration or your how am I trying to explain this? Okay, so I've been fortunate enough to win a gold medal, and I found a great struggle since to find the inspiration that I had with that model.
Yeah,
have you had that? That's
I think there is. There's absolutely the thing, and I know from some friends of mine is that actually the first gold medal is almost the worst, because then you're always thinking, was it just luck? And you know, can I do another one that gets to that level? And yeah, that can cause problems, because then you're thinking, well, is it good enough to do that? Is it good enough to get there? So I think sometimes, yeah, it can almost be a hindrance rather than a benefit.
I think that a lot of people would know you from the local shows around the sort of South UK. Certainly, yeah. That's where I've seen you around. Yeah. You know, Farnborough and Salisbury.
Yes.
What do you get out other than profit? What do you get out of going to the shows and meeting people?
Fellow traders found COVID brilliant from the point of view that they did really well online. I did really well online to start with, and they decided they're not going to go to shows again. They've managed to keep that momentum going. Oh. And before COVID, I really got frustrated with shows. I got fed up with them. I thought, I've had enough of these. And it was a chore. But actually realized during COVID, I actually missed going out there and talking to people at shows. So it really is, it's chatting with people and getting some, you know, getting some feedback. You know, people will always tell you that they should make a model of their Uncle Tom having a pee somewhere in the Somme or something like that. Yeah, you know, and it'll sell really well.
But because they'll buy one.
Well, no, they usually won't, because it'll be in the wrong scale. But we have in our mind, because of the people that we associate with, that everybody has that same relationship or the same way of going about the hobby as we do. And actually, I was talking to a guy, I think it was a show in Yeovil the other day, and I wanted to find out where did he find out about stuff? So I was expecting him to reel off various Facebook things, possibly an online forum. He said, I get a magazine sometimes, and that was it. Or if I'll go to a show, I might see something. And that was the only way he found out about stuff, which I sort of found incredible in today. And that's the biggest difficulty of being a one-man band is marketing, because it's, you know, there's so little time to do it. Very few people have ever heard of Elan 30 Miniatures, really. And you get to some, like, I know that if I released a World War One pilot, I know I can release a lot of the market might buy a World War One pilot. I've released quite a lot of World War II pilots, but I really haven't got into where that market is. So aircraft modelers, I haven't got a clue Land 13 Miniatures is largely. And it's trying to get in there. And one way you can do that is by selling to retailers. The thing I'd like doing least is cleaning up the castings and putting them in boxes. And if you're doing that and then only making a tiny amount of money because you're selling it through trade, I don't want to do that. So everything I do is direct. And that, you know, so you sell less, but the profit margin is slightly higher. So I now really enjoy going to shows.
Yeah, COVID element makes a difference, doesn't it? Yeah.
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 There's too many shows. And I do think that because I do believe fewer traders are going to attend. And even for the big shows, I mean, if you look at Scale Model World this year, there are far fewer small European traders there. And of course, because of COVID, Zuki Mura aren't there either. But I think even with the smaller local shows, there are fewer traders who are going out about now than there were. And I think some will struggle. I was talking to one of the guys on the committee at the Avon show, and I think they're either going to be, or they charge clubs for a table, or they charge them a small amount for an extra table. And that's something in the UK we're just not used to at all. The clubs go, well, it's my right to come in here free and put my display up. And I think that if they want local shows to continue, might have to change.
I guess traditionally, perhaps each club would put their own show on. So that's why you would invite everyone to your to your venue, because you're hosting this weekend, you know. But I don't think it works that way anymore, you know, especially because people, I don't think they're willing to travel as far. Certainly as I'm getting older, I don't want to be in the car for 3 hours. You know, I mean, the US traders have to be there even earlier than us lot. So it's a stretch, and there are a lot of shows. You are right. It always interests me when I was the very first time I went to Telford. I was a member of the IPMS, and I'm looking at the queue for the people that weren't IPMS members. There are so many people that were going to the Scale Model World as punters, but had nothing to do with the IPMS. And I didn't understand, if you had an interest in something, why wouldn't you join your local club? Why wouldn't you join your local group? And I guess it's not for everyone. You know?
No.
You know. And I suppose that you want to have the sort of fresh people coming in. And that's why the bigger shows are good, because you'll get to meet people that you hadn't met before at your local shows. Yeah. So maybe just do big shows then.
Yes. And again, even with big shows, though, the venues are becoming more and more expensive. Yeah. Milton Keynes, which I'd only ever done once, fantastic venue, but they're not doing another one there because the venue price went up. And I think, again, that's going to happen as well. Venues wanting to make money back because they were closed for 18 months. Usually when clubs do something, they've got a backup of, they can do 1 or 2 years because they've got that money saved back. But after that, they can't keep on running at a loss.
It was one of the things over the COVID period that worried me a lot about the Scale Model World, was that, because it is quite a big, it is an enormous venue, whether they were going to get hit hard. And potentially create a problem for them. I mean, even the price ticket increase this year, which I don't think is unreasonable at all, but it's caused an awful lot of stir. And you're just like, guys, if you want these people to be there next year and the year after, you've got to support them. You know, they're not asking for an awful lot, and it isn't an awful lot for you to add on to the cost of your weekend event or day visit.
No, I absolutely agree with that, and I think that it has gone up. I still think it's pretty good value for money. You know, try taking a family to Legoland, and you suddenly realize what an expensive day out is. Scale Model World could be a lot better. It really could. It is stuck a bit in a time warp. More open now to listen.
Yeah.
They used to have an appalling attitude towards traders. Traders were very much, I felt, seen as the enemy, and they have warmed more now, and it's a much more positive relationship now. But I also think that there is that danger, and I've mentioned it before. I use Euromilitair as an example. Euromilitair went off the boil; it really did go off the boil. But people then started slagging it off, so people started not going. So then European modelers stopped going as well, and the value of a medal at Euromilitair went down. And then it went, and then everybody was saying, "Oh my God, we haven't got a big figure show now in the UK."
Yeah.
And no, we haven't. Yeah, and that's now moved over into Europe. And, a lot of people have offered a lot of constructive criticism, and some people have tried hard, I know, to try and talk to the organisers about that. And there are a lot of countries around the world that would love to have a show of that scale. And it's really the only massive show. I mean, and now no doubt people in Scotland will be howling at me. How dare you say that? We've got a big one in Scotland. Possibly they have. But it is a big show. And I think one thing it has done is it's got a wider variety of stuff than it used to. It isn't all aircraft now. There's a lot of stuff there now. There are quite a few figure, manufacturers and retailers going there. Lots of AFV, lots of other stuff as well. And that does make it, I think, a more interesting event than perhaps it used to be.
We always talk about on the show, don't we, are the big advocates for all the other hobbies,
that
use the same techniques and the same paints and the same everything that we do, just use it in a different way.
Well, we are all terribly tribal, though. What do you mean trained modelers do that? They don't know what they're doing, do they? The whole of the hobby world is like a porcupine. And then actual scale modelling is one of the spines. And you've got aircraft modelling taking up most of it. AFV modelling taking up the next bit. And then figure modellers are the pricks at the end. And that's absolutely what we are. Yeah. And I think you have to realise that. You know, you have to realise that is where we are. You know, go into Smith's and what do you see? You don't see many figure modeling magazines. Yeah, you'll see magazines with tractors in. Malcolm's okay, but that's how it is. And we do have to realise that.
I find it really weird, actually, if you go into a high street, WH Smith's, and there's loads of tractors. It's a high street. It's not in the country.
So? I live in a town. I still like my tractors.
I got a WH Smith's on my railway station. There's no railway magazines. It's tractors.
It's interesting, I suppose, yeah. That's a good point.
I'll quiz them next time I'm there having coffee. a lot of the shows have different things that could improve. We as a community must support those shows and be advocates of the shows. And it's just, if there are faults, then we have to be constructive. The best way that I can see, when you put your model into a competition and you want feedback, what feedback do you want? Do you want the criticism that's going to cut you and not make you put into a competition again? Or do you want the constructive criticism that makes your model in journey better? Mm. And it's the same with the shows. It's no different.
I think the hobby would be worse off without model shows. I really do.
Yeah. There's no way that I would be doing what I was doing if I hadn't gone to Salisbury model shows 7-8 years ago and saw the massive community that there is and the talent that there is and, you know, the fun people that there are and the variety of stuff that you can do.
And I fully appreciate some people can't get to shows, you know, for whatever reason, they aren't able to. And so they can only experience it online. And you know, online is, again, you know, they spend hours talking about how online has helped the model making, which it has hugely. But I do think that actually seeing things physically is very different. And again, that goes back to when people take photographs from shows and they say, oh, why didn't this get a gold medal? Why didn't that get a medal? Mm-hmm. You know, because you haven't held it in your hand. You know, that, you know, if you're judging, you know, I know why that got that or didn't, because I held that in my hand and I looked at it closely and turned it round and did that. And like you were saying, Malcolm, and decided that the leaves were too big. You know, but you don't see that in a photograph.
A classic example of the perceptions that we were talking about earlier, how people see things. And a photograph is not necessarily a true likeness of what it is. Absolutely.
I have one last question I'd love to ask you, Robert. What was the last kit or figure that you gave away and why?
I gave a couple away to kids that come up to the stand sometimes, so they're like kits. You know, if you get a young person coming up and they're showing interest, I don't do it a lot because I go out of business if I did, but I have done that in the past. I've done a few. I mean, for friends, I've sculpted the odd piece for them that I'm charged for. So do that.
Okay, I'm quite young, and you never give me anything for free.
Oh, hang on. You might be wearing shorts, Malcolm. That's not the case, I'm afraid. going back to that, when you have given away to a youngster showing interest, did they feed back to you what they've done with it?
And I haven't had that. No, I haven't had that.
Really?
I quite often don't, you know, you don't see me. It doesn't mean they've given up modeling. It doesn't mean they've had their Elan kit and thought, oh my God, I'm never going to do any more of that. And that's it. And I've killed off their enthusiasm for the hobby.
I haven't
had that back, but you know, I think as part of the trade, you have got to try and encourage, you know, new people. It doesn't have to be kids actually, but new people into doing things if you possibly can, because it just helps keep things going. The other thing, we were saying right at the beginning about, you know, people are saying, you know, the other thing that people like to say is the hobby's dying. And I just think that's such a load of rubbish. You know, the variety of stuff that's available now, you know, it blows your mind in comparison to how it was 10 years ago or 5 years ago even. Mm. And actually, there are a lot of young people doing modelling just because they're not doing what we did. When we were young, doesn't mean they're not doing it. They're in, my grandson now, who is in year five, he loves doing gaming figures. So he does Star Wars figures. He paints those, paints them brilliantly. And, you know, he got that off his dad, who, you know, got that off me. But you know, just because they're not building Airfix kits, that doesn't mean they're not interested in it. And it doesn't mean they won't be doing it. I don't think this generation is lost to computer games at all. You know, they're just doing other stuff, but it's still that creative stuff that they're doing, which one day might get them to make a model kit or might not, you know. I think it could be a Gundam kit or it could be something else, MAK, you know, it could be anything.
Yes. Computer games, talking about that very quickly, World of Tanks. Mm-hmm. At the Tank Museum, they have, you know, the computer games and things like that. You can go along and play the games. But then when they come out of the gift shop, they buy the model of the tank they like the best to build. As enthusiasts, that's what got me into modeling, because I like airplanes. So I bought the model that I think I want.
Yeah, I bought my grandson one of the World of Tanks. Revell do them, don't they? I bought one of those. I can't remember, but I bought him one of those. Mind you, at the tank shop, at Bovington, the weirdest gift you can ever buy is a cuddly Panzerfaust. Have you seen that? Why would anybody want a furry? Here we are, son. Take that to bed with you. It's a Panzerfaust. Just don't point it at anybody.
I'm sure there is a use for it in some circles, but I can't think what. But that's a good point. I don't think I ever saw a furry Panzerfaust.
Yeah.
Tank slippers. I saw that and inflatable.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I can understand bullets. Tank slippers.
Tank slippers, just, yeah, I don't get them. Sorry.
Tank slippers, yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want them, but I can see why they're there. But, yeah. But I can't see the cuddly Panzerfaust. Just goes totally over my head, I'm afraid.
Christmas is coming up, so.
If Bobberton's listening, you're going to get one in the post. You know that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what? It's been a fascinating interview. Really, really fascinating. Yeah. I've learned so much. Thank you so much for your time. It's been brilliant.
No, I've really enjoyed it. I really have. And thank you. I love your podcast. I really do. I was listening to your one on photography today. Went back to listen to that one. So it was interesting to see what you said on that. The relationship you two have with each other is superb. It works so well. It's just it's different from the other podcasts that I listen to. And I really do enjoy it.
I really appreciate you the time that you give to the hobby and the people that come and chat to you at your stand as well. Mm. Oh, the other thing, whereabouts can people find news about Land 13?
Land 13 Miniatures on Facebook or Robert Lane on Facebook. And website is land13.co.uk.
Fantastic. What's your next show?
Next one is Yeovil, which is at the end of this month, and then Telford after that.
I'll see you at Telford.
Yes.
Awesome.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Robert.
Oh, thank you very much.
Big fan of the show, Robert Lane. I was quite taken aback, actually, when he said that he liked listening to us. You know, I hold a lot of these guys in very high regard. So when someone actually says they enjoy the content that we make, it makes me feel quite giddy. Interesting thing about Robert was his interest and passion for the hobby was so much that he was willing to give up his main job as a headmaster and start a company called Land 13 that he doesn't make much money out of, but he's been doing it since the 90s. And then my hat has to come off to him because I see him at loads of shows, loads of shows, and he's all got a smile on his face. He's always bubbly and cheery, and
yeah, he works hard.
He's always got something new on the stand. He's always got time for you.
The thing that came across so amazingly to me was just the level of passion he has for it. You know, one of the dangers of starting your own business that's connected to your hobby is that it can a drive you insane, but also it can affect your passion greatly, because the difference between a hobby and a business is vast. So much more than I think we appreciate the fact that he can still carry that amount of passion for what he's doing. I've met him a couple of times at shows, and that's been abundantly clear in the shows as well. So it's not just a case of he's come onto an interview and we've caught him in the right mood. He just is constantly like that.
Yeah. Well, I hope you at home or you in the car or you in the garden, I hope that you enjoyed that interview. And if you see a Land 13 at your local model show, go and say hi.
And if you don't get to model shows, check him out online. You've been listening to Just Making Conversation with
James Skiffins
and Malcolm Childs.
Follow us on Facebook, where we post photos, updates and other nonsense.
Find us on Spotify, Amazon Music, iTunes, Google Podcasts and all those others.
Let us know what you're just making and what your thoughts are on the conversation in this episode.
Thank you to the following supporters from buymeacoffee.com /JMC Podcast.
Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Mike Shelley, Ivana Build a Model Kit, Callum from Micro Machines Podcasts, Paint All the Minis Peter, Brad, Warren, Mike, Black Rifle, Tim, John, Julian, Chuck, Mark, Becca, Wahi, Simon the Jersey Gent, Steve, Lee, Costas, Mark, Ray, Neil, Mike, Robert, Andrew, Drew, John, Mike, Jeff, Richard, Lynn, Gordon, and six others.
If you do show your support, leave your name so we can paint the roll of honour on the towel of the next episode. Goodbye.
Goodbye.